Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming along. I'd like to talk for about 10 minutes or so, just to try and create as full a picture as I can briefly of what we've been doing for 2 weeks. Those of you who listened to me speak before we went will remember the musical analogy I was using of a three-movement symphony with a finale. So at this point in time, we've got to the end of the first movement, no more. So there's still a slow movement to come, a time of attentive listening, and then a third movement, and then there'll be a finale from the Holy Father. In the first movement, let me speak about the tones of the music and the structure of the composition. The tones were set by Pope Francis when he said at the beginning, I want you to bring the voice of the local church. I want you to speak openly and with vigour. And I want you to listen humbly. And he said, my presence as Pope will guarantee the peace and the tranquility in which we can all do this. The structure of the music, and that tone was maintained throughout the week. Of course, different views were expressed, there were disagreements, but never was that tone, that spirit of honest speaking and listening attentively, humbly, with charity, it never wavered at all. The way the first movement evolved was like this. The first week, as you know, was a reflection on the situation, based on the Instrumentum Laboris, and then added to by 280 speeches of people speaking, mostly bringing the voice of their local church. So what we had was a very, very big canvas, and the voices telling us about the situation of the family included all of these issues: the impact of war, of immigration, domestic violence, polygamy, problems with adoption, sexual exploitation and trafficking, cohabitation, civil marriages, interreligious marriages, especially with Orthodox Muslims and Hindus, patterns of traditional marriage in different parts of the world, the drama in people's lives of divorce and remarried. There was a lovely picture from some of the African people who spoke about their tradition of marriage having at its heart reconciliation. So when two families marry, they present a spear because hostilities between us are now over. And when the young couple get into difficulties, it's the family duty to work at reconciliation between the two of them. One of the strongest voices that I heard in that first week was from a fair number of bishops, and one said, I speak on behalf of 11 bishops' conferences, at their anger at the way that aid from the First World and from international organisations is tied to their taking on board abortion, systematic contraception for the limiting of births. They said the word they used was blackmail. The word they used is they use our poverty against us. And one bishop stood and said, keep the money. We'd rather have our values, our pro-life values, than this. There were some theological themes. There was quite an exploration of a deeper understanding of Eucharist as reflecting the spousal relationship between Christ and his church. There was a strong emphasis on marriage as a sanctuary of holiness, and therefore getting married is a response to a call from the Lord. It is seen as a vocation, and therefore something about the role of faith in the act of getting married. There was quite an exploration of the importance of baptism as the foundation of Christian living, and therefore the continuing foundation of people's lives. We looked at the law of gradualness, and I think in the end came to understand that that is strictly a law taken out of moral theology and doesn't apply terribly well
to our understanding of how God reveals his purpose. We also looked at paragraph 8 of Lumen Gentium, of the recognition of elements of sanctification in other Christian churches, and came to the conclusion that that did not apply analogously to people who are in second marriages, though there we look indeed for the seeds of the word, the elements of grace that are present in people's lives. So if you want a theological analogy, it was more with the document on other religions, but there are theological points which you can explore a bit more if you wish. In the first week, there was a very clear challenge expressed as to the language we use. There was a lot of emphasis on the need for support, for preparation, for a ministry of accompaniment. There was an emphasis on the role of priests, and there was also a desire to see this whole process in the life of the church as challenging societies and how they view and respond to the needs of supporting families. First step. Second step, there was the interim report that came out at the end of the first week. You know, its tones were strongly pastoral, and that was absolutely accepted and supported. I think many people thought it wasn't balanced because it didn't also present a vision of the teaching of the church and a vision of the goodness of marriage. And there was a broad view that it was careless in its use of language at some points. So then we had a week of small group discussions in 10 groups, which used 4 different languages. Now, I was in a group in which native English speakers were very much a minority. So it was a worldwide group. It had somebody from Japan. It had quite a number of people from Africa and somebody from Argentina. Quite a wide range of people who were speaking English. Now, overall, at the end of those 4.5 days, I think it was on Thursday morning, if I remember rightly, we heard the reports from these 10 groups. And I picked out the 4 key themes from these reports. One was a desire that the synod gave a trumpet call in support of marriage and family life. As one of the reports said, if the church doesn't do this, who will? So that was the first point. Secondly, we wanted to see in the following document, the document which was to follow, a much more systematic presentation of the richness of the church's teaching. Thirdly, we wanted the document to call for and see the ways of intensifying the pastoral consciousness and sensitivity of the church, and to find a way to renew that pastoral aspect of the life of every Christian. One of the texts spoke of the art of accompanying people, the art of walking alongside, and that was a strong point. And then the fourth point was to address explicitly some of the difficult situations that we were recognizing. So, and in that particular fourth point was the insistence that pastorally we would always seek the positive in the life of every person whom we were accompanying. So then we got to the last stage of these 2 weeks, which was the formulation and then expression of agreement or disagreement on what is called the Synod Report. This is an important point to notice. Normally, at the end of a synod, there's a final report, and it's normally cast in terms of propositions or statements around which agreement is sought. And at the end of all the other synods, if a paragraph or a proposition does not get 2/3 majority, then it's dropped. Now, this synod is different, because it's not a final report. Nowhere will you find the phrase final report. It's a report of the synod. a ratio synody. And that's why it's a point of a new departure. So it's the point at which the second movement begins. Now, in the document, which, as far as I know, has not yet been made available in English. It's a long document. It's 60-plus paragraphs. 62 paragraphs. And I would say it corresponds pretty closely to those four points that I just made, that it is a powerful trumpet call for marriage. It does have an exposition of the richness of the church's teaching. It does highlight steps to be taken to intensify the pastoral care of the church, and it does address some of the very difficult situations. The three paragraphs around which there was not a two-thirds majority gained were on the questions of how to approach the access to the Eucharist for people in second marriages. The second one was a paragraph about spiritual communion, about the practice of spiritual communion in the church. And the third one was the question of the pastoral response to people of same-sex orientation or in civil partnerships. So then we came to the Holy Father's address at the end. And if I can speak very personally, it was a most astonishing and I found very, very moving address. Some of the commentators of Rome have said this is one of the most important addresses of his pontificate, without a doubt. And to have been there, to have heard it firsthand, for me was a great privilege. I turned to the bishop next to me, the cardinal next to me, and I said, it's been worth being in Rome for 2 weeks just to hear that. And so that's why, and I think there's texts for you if you have them already. But it showed you so much of his heart and of his intention. So he begins by just describing the emotions of the week that we've been through. And that's a very human thing to do. You know, he said some of the time we've rushed as if we want to conquer time. Some of the time we've been tired out and wanted to say, enough, enough, can't this stop? We've had moments of enthusiasm and of ardour, probably not the best English word. And then he moves into a very Ignatian mode. He identifies the consolations. Now, by consolation, he means when our hearts are warmed, the heart of faith, when that is warmed. And that is when listening to, as he said, the wisdom of pastors and to the testimonies of families who participated in the synod. And then he talks about moments of desolation. So the opposite, when the heart of faith is troubled and gets fearful or anxious. And he spoke then about the temptations that we have faced. It was a most remarkable moment because he basically, as it were, opened up for us all the ways in which we had not been at our best. And of course, against every one of these temptations, you know, you could say, yes, I recognize that in me. And they're so important because they show how perceptive he is and how much he is concerned about this synod as a spiritual journey, as a journey to get us closer to the Lord. So what are the temptations? One is wanting to close oneself within the written word, not allowing oneself to be surprised by God. And he said, from the time of Christ, this is the temptation of the zealous, the scrupulous, of the solicitous, or the so-called today, traditionalists and intellectuals. So if you're boxed into a system of thought, or you're boxed into a purely abstract academic thing, then that's the temptation you're falling into. The second one was the temptation to a restrictive tendency to goodness. That's difficult to translate. The Italian word is buonismo. And I think probably the colloquial expression of it in English is do-gooders. So what he's saying is, it won't do simply to bind wounds. You have to try and heal the wounds first. So coming up with quick, easy solutions, coming up with saying, well, if everyone could be admitted to the Eucharist, that would be done. He's saying that's just binding a wound. It's not trying to cure it. And he said this is the temptation of the so-called progressives and liberals. Then he kind of gave those two a scriptural reflection by talking about transforming stones into bread very quickly and simply, or transforming bread into stones to burden people. Then the fourth temptation, and I think this is the most telling, the temptation to come down off the cross to please the people and not to stay there in order to fulfill the will of the Father, to bow down to a worldly spirit instead of purifying it and bending it to the Spirit of God. Now, I put my hand up to that temptation because this is the temptation of people who verge towards being activists, wanting to get things done. And he's saying, no, sometimes we stop still. We stay with the suffering and we do not rush on. And we have to stay there, to stay and to recognize the presence of the cross, which is purifying for us. And then the fifth one is a little bit of a repeat. It's taking the responsibility of the church for its deposit of faith and thinking that we're owners and masters of it. In other words, to say we're in charge of the deposit of faith. We kind of govern it, and therefore we can put it to one side if we want to. And then he followed with these words, which are his reflection on the 2 weeks synod. Personally, I would be very worried or saddened if it were not for these temptations and these animated discussions, if we were all in a state of agreement or silent in a false and quietest peace. Instead, I have seen and I have heard with joy and appreciation speeches and interventions full of faith, full of pastoral and doctrinal zeal, full of wisdom, of frankness and courage. And I have felt that what's been set before our eyes was the good of the church, of families, and always the supreme law, the good of souls. Then he went on in the second half of his speech to talk about his role as Pope. And again, you have to read this. He says, I will now speak a little bit about the Pope now in relation to the bishops, and laughed. He said, you know, as if this is a bit odd, but it's very important. The duty of the Pope is that of guaranteeing the unity of the Church. It is that of reminding the faithful and the pastors of their daily duty to follow Christ, and most of all, to serve, I'm paraphrasing now, with a fatherly care and mercy and without any false fears to welcome the lost sheep. I made a mistake there, he said. I said welcome. Rather, we should be going out to find. And then he gave a long quote from Benedict XVI, and then he said, he implied that the title he likes best as Pope is that of the servant of the servants of God, because it is which is his first priority to maintain, even as he says, being the supreme pastor and teacher of the faithful, even enjoying supreme, full, immediate, and universal ordinary power in the church. It's a long time since I've heard that phrase from canon law quoted. So Pope Francis is saying, don't be anxious. Here is the visible source of unity guaranteed by the gift of the Lord, and you can trust me. So to me, that was the highlights of the whole synod, frankly. And if anybody wants really to understand the process of the synod as Pope Francis sees it, you have to read that text. And you have to see that in his mind, this is not an exercise in democracy, It's not a manipulation of power groups or of interest groups. This is a pathway of genuine discernment. And he's patient, he's perceptive, and he knows that we're at the end of the first movement, and that's all.